Reading the news, you might think that Christians hate Muslims, Muslims hate Jews, Jews hate Muslims. Can't we all just get along? Well, we can. We have. Dwight Reynolds is a professor of Arabic language and literature at the University of California. He told Steve Paulson that we all, Christian, Muslim, and Jew, got along during a period of religious tolerance in Al-Andalus.
The Arabs conquer Spain, or rather Muslim forces invade Iberia in 711. We don't know much about the music for the first 150 years or so, but already by the early 9th century, mid-9th century, we know of a thriving musical culture in the court of Cordoba, which was the capital of Moorish Spain. And in that court, we have actually many anecdotes and interesting biographies of musicians of various different backgrounds, Jewish, Arab, Christian, perhaps even African, we're not 100% sure about one particular figure, who all perform, mix, and end up over the period of 100, 150 years creating a new type of music that was different from the Arab music of North Africa and the Eastern Mediterranean.
And wasn't Cordoba at that time one of the most sophisticated, one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world?
Indeed. It was the largest city in Western Europe. And it was known far and wide as essentially the most extravagantly civilized and cultured spot in the region. There's a very famous text written by a nun who is writing in Eastern Europe, and she refers to Cordoba by its title, The Ornament of the World.
And you're saying that music was an essential part of that culture.
Indeed. Poetry and music together, other than architecture and gardens, are perhaps the most enduring legacy of Muslim Spain.
Was this considered religious music?
Not what was actually being sung in the court. And now some of it would be, and some of it certainly they would sing praise songs to the Prophet Muhammad, for example, but the vast majority of what was sung in the courtly tradition was much more secular poetry, descriptions of gardens, descriptions of lovers meeting in gardens, having trysts, etc., descriptions of the beloved. But there's an interesting thing about Arabic poetry almost from its very beginnings, but that certainly develops as Sufism, the mystical branch of Islam, develops, and that is that they take over these same poetic images and reinterpret them in mystical ways. So the beloved in a Sufi poem is not a physical human being, but rather God himself. And of course, one pines away and wants to be close to the beloved, which is an expression of one's desire to be unified with the Godhead. If you achieve a very high level of spiritual attainment, the wine that's constantly mentioned in these secular poems and the intoxication is not actual wine or intoxication, but the great ecstasy one feels in worshiping and loving God. So from that point on, it's almost impossible to say that any one particular lyric is or is not religious.
There was one musician in particular who performed at the court of Cordoba, Ziryab.
Ziryab is perhaps, well, almost without doubt, the most famous musician of the Islamic Middle Ages. There's one other figure in Baghdad who might rival him, but otherwise Ziryab, at least for North Africans and people who like modern Andalusian music, he is the major figure. We don't know much about his origins at all. He was trained in Baghdad, but we are told from the very beginning that he was a black slave. So it's possible that he was of African origin. It's possible that he was born in Baghdad, but of slave parentage. Some have tried to speculate that he might have been Baluchi or even Indian. But we know that he was not just dark-skinned, but black. He's constantly always referred to as being black. He supposedly trains under the greatest master in Baghdad and has a row with his master there. He gets an opportunity to perform in front of the Sultan. And the Sultan likes this young fellow so much that his teacher is jealous and afraid that Ziryab might take his place as the Sultan's favorite singer. So in the biographies that have come down to us, he basically takes Ziryab aside one night and says, "This town isn't big enough for the two of us. Either you leave now peaceably, or I'll make sure that you don't live to sing another song." And so he supposedly fled and went across North Africa. And we do know that he arrived in Moorish Spain in 822. And when he arrived with his entourage, and, you know, he began to sing before the Emir of Cordoba. And instantly, the Emir was completely taken with him and gave him outrageous amounts of money and put him up in, you know, in a house that abutted upon the actual royal palace. And
it didn't even have a look, like the way he parted his hair and
absolutely.
All of that?
The biographer tells us that until that time, the Moors, the Andalusian Muslims, all, male and female, parted their hair straight down the middle and let it hang loose down onto both sides. And we know that Ziryab is described as having had bangs that were cut straight across his eyebrows, and that his hair was tucked behind his ears, but that he had two spit curls that came down in front of his ears. So in the end, he becomes far more than a musician. He is the arbiter of taste in the court of Cordoba. And as I've written before, the emir might have had rule in all matters of state, but Ziryab held rule in all matters of taste. Allah yaqul al-kha'inin
'ala shiya. So here was this remarkable flowering of culture, this coming together of these different cultural traditions, different religious traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And this lasted for what, several centuries?
Yes. One thing that we can note in the biography of Ziryab is that the Emir of Cordoba sent his chief musician, his head musician, down to the southern coast to meet him when he landed after crossing the Straits of Gibraltar. And that man's name was Mansur ibn Buhlul, and he was Jewish. And at the same time, one of the famous singing girls in the court when Ziryab arrived was a woman who was given the name Qalam, which is a pen for writing calligraphy with. And what we know about her is that she was originally a Basque Christian. So at one and the same time, we have a Basque Christian singing girl, a Jewish head musician, and a perhaps African musician fresh from Baghdad, who become the three central figures. And this, as you said, continues for several centuries.
So when did this culture of tolerance start to collapse?
As the Christians reconquered the Iberian Peninsula, there were a variety of different reactions to that, because they ended up with Muslim indigenous populations and Jewish indigenous populations now under Christian control. And they had to rework in their minds what the status of these groups was going to be. 1492, of course, is the end of Islamic Spain, the fall of Granada. And it's the fall of Granada that frees up money for the royal treasury to pay Christopher Columbus to go off to the New World. But as just a demonstration of what happens to these people, in 1492, in the surrender agreement, and soon after the surrender, Jews were expelled. This was the reaction of their most Catholic majesties, Ferdinand and Isabella. And so it led to a very, you know, an awful act in that direction. And then Muslims were promised that they could practice their faith in peace and in freedom for all time, for eternity. Well, it turns out that eternity lasted 10 years. And in 1502, people were forcibly converted from, they became conversos, they were converted from Islam to Christianity. Now, they were given the opportunity to leave, and many people asked me, well, if they really loved their faith, why didn't they leave? Well, there were a few little conditions if you wanted to leave. One was that you had to abandon your children. Because, from the Catholic Church's point of view, these were children whose souls had to be saved by turning them over to Christ. And so, as an adult, if you were going to be, you know, from their point of view, if you were going to, you know, cling to your sinfulness and your wrongful path, that was fine, but you shouldn't be allowed to imperil a child's salvation. The other thing was that you couldn't take any gold, silver, or jewels, and you could only leave with what you carried on your back. So you basically could only take your clothes, and you would have to abandon your children. So people stayed, they became converted, and through the entire 16th century can witness sort of like the tightening of the screw, little bit by little bit. There are attempts to outlaw the use of Arabic language, outlaw the possession of Arabic books, outlaw the singing of Arabic songs, outlaw the use of musical instruments that were used by the Moors, outlaw the clothing that were worn by the Moors. In other words, in order to make them good Christians, they basically had to become Spanish as well.
So the effect of all of this was that Spain became a Christian country and lasted that way well into the modern day.
Right.
The music of religious tolerance is still with us today. There are thousands of these songs that have been passed down through the oral tradition, performed regularly in Syria, Morocco, Yemen, and Algeria. Also, it lives with the Sephardic Jews around the world. And it has started to be performed again in Spain. Dwight Reynolds is a professor of Arabic language and literature at the University of California. Steve Paulson spoke with him.